We're launching into this brand new series on the book of Genesis. So we are people who are fascinated with stories, and stories come in a lot of different forms. We're fascinated with movies that tell a good story, with books. We all are readers in our family at some level, and so we all read while we were on vacation and spent some time reading good books, and we enjoy good TV shows that tell good stories. News segments are highlighted because they're telling a story about something good or bad that's happening in the world. Documentaries tell stories of people's lives or events that take place. We are fascinated with stories. We're a story people because we are living out a story in our everyday life. And most stories contain basically five key elements, right? They have characters in the story, the people that make up the story. There's a setting, when the story took place, what was going on. There's always a plot in a story, how the story unfolds. There's conflict in a story, something that creates tension. And then there's resolution in the story. Those five elements are found in every good story. They all have characters and plots and conflict and resolution and plots. Stories always begin with something or someone. I mean, the famous line that begins a lot of stories is "once upon a time." So once upon a time begins stories, and then this kind of plot develops. Once upon a time, there was a girl that finds a cottage in the woods that had three bowls of porridge. And so the story continues. Once upon a time, there was a father who died, and his surviving daughter is mistreated by her evil stepmother. I mean, these are stories that unfold. Once upon a time, I don't know, there was a clownfish that loses his son and embarks on a search to find him, right? So these are stories, and you can tell that I have kids based on the story illustrations I just gave. Stories, once upon a time, stories. There's an author named Christopher Booker who is fascinated with the concept of stories and why we tell stories. And he says that there are basically seven basic plots that all stories fall into. There's the overcoming the monster story, where the primary character, the protagonist, is often called the hero, sets out to defeat some type of evil force, the antagonist in the story. And this evil force threatens the people or his family or the homeland or something. There's a lot of stories written around this theme. It's basically the plot of movies like Star Wars and War of the Worlds and things like that. There's the rags to riches story of someone, some person, some protagonist who has very little or nothing, who acquires great power or wealth or maybe a mate that they desire. Oftentimes, the rag to riches stories is a story of someone gaining it all and then losing it all and regaining it, and in the process, they are transformed. These are stories like Cinderella, or more recently, the movie of Aladdin, or the classic Great Expectations. These are rags to riches stories. There's the story of the quest, where the protagonist sets out with his companions to acquire some important object or to conquer some distant land or to get to a location, and they face obstacles and temptations along the way, and in the process they are transformed. I just got through rereading the classic Christian story of Pilgrim's Progress, and that is a story of conquest, of a pilgrim who sets out to discover the celestial city. Perhaps the most famous series ever written that falls into this category is the Lord of the Rings books and movies of the companions that set out on this conquest, this quest. There's the plot of the voyage and the return, where the protagonist goes to a strange land and overcomes his threats and returns back to his homeland a different person. This is the story of The Hobbit or Alice in Wonderland or the classic SpongeBob the movie. Goes to a different place and comes back a different sponge. The voyage and return. There's comedy, right? There's light movies and humor stories that are driven by kind of a happy or a cheerful ending. Actually, Booker says this is not just comedies that make us laugh, but these include dramas and other stories that have this kind of happy or cheerful ending. Romance movies, the famous rom-com. Has anybody ever not heard the phrase rom-com? Hold your hand up. You're along with me. All right. See, there's a lot of people out here. My kids were like, everybody knows what a rom-com is. No, there's some of us that are older in life that didn't know what the phrase was. Rom-com is a romantic comedy that ends well. And just we're lazy people, so instead of saying romantic comedy, we just like the rom-com. Let me get it out there quick. so we don't have to say the full words. The rom-com, Midsummer Night's Dream. Most recently, Crazy Rich Asians was a comedy that ends, a romantic comedy that ends with a happy and cheerful ending. There's tragedies where the protagonist makes a mistake or has some type of character flaw, and that is their ultimate undoing, their ultimate downfall. Our hero has a chink in his armor that causes their demise. These are the Romeo and Juliet stories of our world, the Bonnie and Clydes. And then there's the story of the rebirth, that some event forces the main character to change their ways, to become a better person. Some of the classics that are around this theme are Beauty and the Beast or A Christmas Carol, where Scrooge becomes a generous person in the end. So these are all plots. These are seven basic plots that give us reasons why we tell stories, that fascinate us, that bring us into the storyline. We identify with stories. And what we discover about the Scriptures is that the Bible is an unfolding story of God's redeeming a people, His people. It begins with the very simple words, in the beginning, God created, and it ends in the book of Revelation with the concept that God makes all things new. In the beginning, God created, and behold, I make all things new. And in between these two bookends is this redemptive narrative that flows, that tells the story of God's redemption. From in the beginning, God created, to God renewing the world under His eternal rule and reign. And our story is filled with drama and emotion and inspiration and miracles and meaning and good and evil. But this story is not just any story. This story is the story. Because if this story is true, if this story is the story, then it has eternal significance, eternal consequences. And like any story, the beginning of this chronicle is very vital to the rest of the story. And so the opening stories of the Scriptures are very revealing. They introduce us to the primary character, to the protagonist of the story of the Bible, the central character that the story is about. Because the story of the Bible is ultimately His story. God is the hero of the story of the Bible. And we tend to take the stories out and make the individual characters in the story the heroes. We tend to elevate the Davids and the Daniels and the disciples and the different characters that play a part of God's redemptive story. But at the end of the day, the story of the Bible is the story of God. It is His story and His story of redemption. So this morning, as we began this new series from the opening act one, scene one of this redemptive story, we are introduced to this primary character with very simple words. So the very first phrase, the very first page of our story, the opening scene of our story is Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. The word Genesis actually means beginnings. And so it is the beginning of our story. And so in the book of beginnings, the book of Genesis, we read this very simple phrase, in the beginning, God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But it really begins with those first four words. In the beginning, God. You see, when you open up the Bible, when you open up the Scriptures, there's an assumption that's made. And this assumption is made in the opening scene. In the beginning, God. There's no once upon a time in the story of the Bible. It's just an assumption that when time began, there was a God. That the story begins with God, a being we call God who existed before time, before anything. Before everything, that God existed before anything existed, including time itself. Now, that is difficult for us to wrap our minds around because we are time-space creatures. We can only think within time and within space. As a matter of fact, let's do a little game today. So just for a moment, let your minds go blank. If you need to close your eyes and meditate to do this, feel free to do so. I want you to take a moment and think about nothing. Go ahead, think about nothing. Think about nothing. Go. Are you thinking about nothing? You can't think about nothing because when we think, we are thinking about something or someone. I know all you wives are like, Devin, you haven't spent any time with my husband. He thinks about nothing all the time. As a matter of fact, when I ask him, what are you thinking about? His reply is, nothing. Yeah, you're thinking about something. You may be thinking about nothing, but you're thinking about something, because thinking about nothing is thinking about something. Does that make sense to you? I drove for 15 hours, or was on a plane and a car for 15 hours yesterday, so whatever comes out, I'm unaccountable for, okay? When you say you're thinking about nothing, you're thinking about something. Even putting the words together, the word together, when your wife asks, what are you thinking about? To put the word together, nothing, you have to think about that. You have to think about saying the word nothing. We can't think about nothing because we are time-space creatures. When you think, your thinking begins with something or someone. So our minds can't even fathom nothing. We always begin with something, with someone. That's how our minds process. But this story, story of the Bible, begins with this assumption, with this belief. God existed before anything and everything. Before time, God existed. So this is important to understand because Genesis, the book of Genesis, is not a scientific textbook that's attempting to prove the existence of God to you. The book of the scriptures, the book of Genesis, is not a science book. It's not, all right, now let me break it down for you. This is why creation is true and evolution is not true. That's not the purpose of the Bible. The purpose of the book of Genesis is to fit into this redemptive narrative. It assumes when you open up the pages that there is a God who exists. It's not the goal to prove creation to you. It is a narrative written to reveal the God of creation. The emphasis is always on God, not on the creation. That's why the whole creative event, God creating and speaking the world into existence, is covered in just two chapters in the book of Genesis. It's only two chapters that God gives us kind of this summary of what happened at creation. Because the goal of the Bible is not to persuade you that there is a creator. It assumes from the opening pages, there is a creator. In the beginning, God. In the beginning, God existed. God is there. This implies that God is eternal, that he is the uncaused cause. Like, we only think in terms of cause and effect. You are here because you've had parents that conceived you and you were born. Everything in our world is the result of something. It's cause and effect. Everything exists because there was a creator of that. And yet we are introduced in the opening phrase of the Bible to an uncaused cause. That no one caused God to exist. That nothing caused God to exist. That God has simply eternally existed. And this eternal being, the scriptures say what? In the beginning, God did what? He created the heavens and the earth. That this uncaused cause created, that he gave other beings the gift of existence. That this story opens with the one true eternal God who is both the author of the book, he is the subject of all of history, and everything is created by him and depends upon him. Now here's the fascinating thing about that. This God, this eternal God, who existed before time, who existed before everything, this God creates out of nothing. The word that we use, the Latin word that describes that, is the word ex nihilo, the phrase ex nihilo. It means that God created out of nothing. That he creates a place, that he creates a people different from him, outside of him. It's part of what makes God holy. The very word holy means to be set apart, to be distinct from. And so God creates a people who are outside of him, a place who is outside of him, and that is the story of Genesis 1 and 2, that God speaks and it happens. So over and over and over and over again in this text, the scriptures say, and God said, and it happens. We're not going to put these verses on the screen, but let me just give you a glimpse of them. Verse 3, and God said, let there be light. And guess what? There was light. God said it, and it happens. Verse 6, and God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters, and it was so. Verse 9, God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place. Let the dry land appear, and it was so. Verse 11, and God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seeds, and fruit trees bearing fruit, in which is their seed, each according to his kind on the earth. And it was so. So Verse 14, and God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And it was so. Verse 20, and God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the heavens across the expanse of the heavens. So God created all these things, and it was so. Verse 24, and God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kind, livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. Over and over and over and over again, the pattern of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 is that God says something. He proclaims it. There's this proclamation. God said, God commands something to happen. Let there be light. Let there be oceans. Let there be creatures. God commands something. He proclaims it. God said, God commands it. Let there be. God separates day from night, water from land, animals from planets. God separates things. God decrees things into existence. The scripture simply says, and it was so. God spoke it, and it happened. And then there's this assessment. And the scriptures say, and it was good. So over and over again, God proclaims, God commands, God separates, God decrees, and then God assesses. Everything that he created was good. And this creative pattern demonstrates from the very beginning that God's word is living, is active, it's powerful. It accomplishes what it decrees. Now, I think it's hard for us to wrap our minds around this simple truth that God speaks and stuff happens. Like, that is fascinating to me. That God speaks and mountains appear. That God speaks and the ocean is filled with creatures. You're around the ocean a lot this week, and to try to wrap your minds around the magnitude of the ocean and what lives in the ocean, that the ocean at places is deeper than any human technology can even descend into the depths of the ocean to even know what's there. And there's estimations of the billions of creatures that just live in the oceans itself. And God speaks and those things appear. I mean, you think about the amount of animals and creatures and crawling things that live upon our earth, and God speaks a word and those things appear. That God speaks and things just happen. God speaks and stuff takes place. That's the type of God that we serve, the type of God that we worship, the type of God that we are introduced to in the book of Genesis. In the beginning, God. In the beginning, God created. Now, what does that mean? It means God speaks and stuff begins to take place. That is a powerful God that speaks and stuff happens. This God speaks and then he creates his most prized creation. Verse 26 of chapter 1. Then God said, let us, Trinity there, let us make man in, here we go again, plural word, in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the livestock and all over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Out of all the creative patterns of God, we are introduced to the most prized creation of God. As God speaks life and humans are formed, male and female are created. The only creation that is created in the image of God, which means that we have emotion, that means that we have intellect, that means that we have will, that means that we are unique to all of God's creation, that we are his most prized creation. And so in Genesis 1 and 2, God creates this perfect world, this ideal world, a world of absolute freedom, a world without limits, a world where there is no death, there is no disease, there is no sickness, there is no pain, there is no suffering. And he places humanity, he places humans in paradise. Now that would have been a pretty cool neighborhood to live in, right? And he places us there in the garden to enjoy God, to enjoy creation, to enjoy each other. This is the purpose of God from the opening pages of the scripture, is to place humans into an environment where they could enjoy God, enjoy each other, enjoy the created world. That's what we were created for. And God places us into this environment, being made in the image of God. So why did God create? Was he lonely? Was he sitting in heaven and twiddling his thumbs and like, well, I've been around forever. I'm getting a little lonely up here. No, God didn't create because he was lonely. Did God create because he was bored? I need some toys to play with. I'm going to create some humans, some animals. No, God wasn't lonely. He wasn't bored. He didn't need a toy. He didn't want friends. The short answer for why God created is that he created for his pleasure, for his purposes. The book of Revelation says that for his pleasure, all things were created. Paul tells us in Colossians 1:16, all things were created by him and for him. Being made in the image and likeness of God, humans have the ability to know God, to love him, to worship him, to serve him, to enjoy him, to have relationship with him. So what a beautiful story we have starting out. That this eternal being who has existed before anything and everything creates. He creates a world. He creates humans. Not because he needs us, but because he wants to be in relationship with us. He wants us to be in relationship with him and with each other. And so we have this beautiful story of harmony and peace and fulfillment and innocence and unlimited potential. But as with any story, there is a story within the story. There's a plot. There's a thesis and an antithesis, right? There is a plot line. There is a conflict. And we will see there is a resolution. And we'll get to all of that part of the rest of this story next week. But before we end today, I want to remind you of a few things that are important. One, what does creation reveal to us about the Creator? In Genesis 1 and 2, what does it tell us about God? Well, let's remind us of about God. And here's just some things. You want to jot these down, then do so. It reminds us that, one, God is the only true God. We sang about it. There is no other God. It is our God. He is a unique God. There is only one true God. And we discover that this God, even from the opening pages of our story, is a Trinitarian God. He is God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit. Let us make man in our image. That there is this complete, holy, eternal, complete God who is the only true God, who is a unique God in every way that we can't begin to wrap our minds around or comprehend. Like, explain the Trinity to me, right? And we'll put it in a book and make a lot of money. It's not something that you can explain or begin to wrap your mind around. We have to take what the scriptures say, that this God who is equally Father, Son, and Spirit, and yet unique persons within that Godhead, we can't comprehend that. And it makes God the only true God, that there is no other God like him. And we are introduced to this God. In the beginning, God. We are also reminded that God is eternal. That he is the uncaused cause. That there is no cause behind God. You know, you every once in a while run into that person that wants to show their intelligence by saying, hey, Devin, I got a question for you. Because you probably have never thought of this. My uncle is one of these people. He will not listen to the podcast, so I'm safe here. Devin, I got a question for you. Where did God come from? Who created God? Oh, you've blown my mind. I don't know. I'm walking away from my faith. I've never thought of that before. There is no explanation of where God came from, right? Because God has eternally existed. Why do we ask that question? We ask that question because we live, right? June the 9th, 2019, on planet Earth, in North Alabama. In Vindicator right now, inside these walls that we call City Church, we are time, space creatures. We can only think in time. We can only think in space. We can't think before time. We can't think after time. We can only think within time. And so we can't get something that is above time, something that is beyond time, something that is looking down on time. God is not within time. He is above time. And so this is a very simple illustration, but maybe it can help us begin to understand. If my podium this morning represents time, if this represents the beginning of time, and this represents the end of all time, guess what? God's not on the podium. God's above the podium. He sees above time. He is a beyond time. Before time existed, beyond when time will end, God is above it. He sees it all. He calls himself in Exodus chapter 6, I am the great I am. What does that mean? It means that I am everything past, everything present, everything future. I'm not limited to your time and your space. I created your time and space. The God that we serve is an eternal God. Nothing's going to catch him off guard. Nothing surprises him. Nothing enters your life where God says, oh man, I wasn't expecting that one. How are we going to react to this? What are we going to do? No, God is above all of that. God is an eternal God, the great uncaused cause. It also reminds us that God is living. God is a creator. He's a giver of life. He is a sustainer of life. That our God is alive. The very last night that we were in Cancun together, we kind of went out into the downtown area, into the markets where they're trying to sell you the same trinkets in every single booth. And there's like 1,000 of them trying to sell you the same stuff. But we decided we were going to eat some authentic Mexican food. And so in this particular market, not only are they trying to get you to buy their stuff, they also are trying to convince you to eat at their restaurant. And so people are like, hey, look at my menu. Hey, look at my menu. Hey, look at my menu. I'll give you all the free drinks that you want starting out. So there's a kind of this bartering process that happens. And so this one guy who happened to be the super salesman of the group lured us into his place and sat us down. And we started this conversation. He was a very hospitable, outgoing guy. And we started this conversation. And in the midst of this conversation, he said, I love the Newsboys. I love the song. What's the song? Our God is not dead. He's a roaring lion. And he said, look, chill bumps. Like even saying it, our God is not dead. He is a roaring lion. Our God is a living God, an active God, a God who is alive. And so God is living. He is active. We're also reminded in this text that God is independent. He's not dependent on you. He's not dependent on us. We're dependent. If you don't believe that, like, all right, then, you know, start breathing on your own. We are dependent, right? We're dependent on him. He is not. This is gospel right here. He doesn't need you. He doesn't need me. He wants us. He desires relationship with us. Did you know God being God does not hinge on whatever decisions you make? Doesn't hinge on whatever you do in your life, right? Now, that doesn't mean God's removed. It means he's very active in our lives, but God doesn't need us. We are dependent upon him. He is independent of us. It also reminds us that God is active and personal. He is not removed from his creation. He gets his hands dirty. In chapter 2, when he creates Adam and Eve, he creates them out of the mud. He is an active and personal God that is not removed. He comes down. He descends to us. It also reminds us that God is powerful, that God speaks and stuff happens. You know that happens in your life today. Stuff happens in your life because God decrees it and God declares it. God speaks it and stuff happens in to our lives. He is a powerful God. I'm also reminded that God is a beautiful God. I mean, look around at the world in which we live. Amidst all the craziness and the lack of beauty sometimes that we see around us, we can lose sight of the beauty of the created world that God has created. We're reminded this week of the beauty of the world in which we live, that God is a beautiful God who has created a beautiful world for us to live. I'm also reminded of Genesis 1, that God is holy. That we were created pure, and that one day God will restore the earth. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and then in the end, all things will be recreated. All things will become new, that God is restoring, that God is holy, is separated from us, and yet he is pushing things toward that final redemption. We're also reminded that God is love, that he desires relationship with humanity, that is driven by this pure love, a desire to love his creation. Of course, we are reminded that God is sovereign, that he rules over all, that there is nothing greater than God or bigger than God, that God is absolutely sovereign. And so all of these things, all of these characteristics about God remind us at the end of the day, from the opening phrase of the Bible, in the beginning, God, that God is worthy of our worship, that he is worthy of our devotion, that there is no God like our God. And so that we can worship him, that we can present ourselves to him, and that he is worthy of the worship that we present. We're reminded of who God is in Genesis chapter 1. And then from this narrative, I again want to remind us about us, like the created. Not only the things about the creator, but what about the created? And I want to remind you this morning that you are created by God and for God, for his pleasure. God created us for his pleasure and for our good, that we are created by God and for God. And what that means specifically is that we are created for relationship. We are created for relationship with this creator God. We are created for relationship with the creation, the created world in which we live, that we live within that world, and there's a call to protect that and to steward it, as God says in Genesis chapter 1, that we just don't live life with no regard for the created world in which we live, that we are created in this world to have a relationship with the world in which we were created, and that we are created to have relationship with each other. Other created human beings. So this creationship with God and with creation itself and with each other. And then I really want to emphasize this one. We are image bearers of God. We are the image bearers of God. All of us. Each created person in the world in which we live bears the image of Creator God. Let me tell you how that kind of breaks down in our everyday. What that means is, as the image bearer of God, I seek to advance his kingdom, not my kingdom. That I am a citizen of his kingdom. That I am an image bearer of the Almighty God. And that as a follower of God, I seek to advance the kingdom of our King. Not Devin the King, small K King, but God, the eternal big K King. That it is his kingdom that I am to be about. That I am to seek to advance his kingdom and not my kingdom. Now, let me tell you what that means very practically. We as citizens of God's kingdom, as image bearers of God, as followers of God, we should be leading the charge to fight against things that distort or destroy the image of God in other people. That means we fight against injustice. We fight against injustice. Because each person is an image bearer of God. We fight against evil. We fight against oppression. And we work for justice. We work for mercy. We work for people to be treated fairly and kindly. And as image bearers of God, we work for things that promote the value of humans. We are image bearers of God. You know what that also means? It means that we respect all human life. We respect all human life because all of us have been created in the image of God. We respect those who have been oppressed. We respect and value those who have been sick. We respect the elderly. We honor the elderly as they near the end of their lives and are at a place where they may not know everything and they're losing their minds and their abilities. Like, we should honor them and respect their human life and protect them and try to take care of them. You know what it also means? It means the very opposite, that we also value the unborn, those who are alive and in wombs. We value the unborn because we believe that is a life created by Almighty God and that God does not make mistakes. Like, this is not a political issue for me. This is a life issue. That God has created life and we value that life. That God makes no mistakes. That every living person, inside, outside the womb, is an image bearer of God. And we do what we can to protect that and love that and value that. Now, let me break it down for us as Christians, because we love to stand on our soapboxes and scream and picket and carry signs. But you know what that also means for us? That we also have to be the ones that come alongside and say, we value life. We're not only going to state our opinion constantly, but we're going to be there. We're going to be willing to foster, and we're going to be willing to adopt, and we're going to be willing to love the unloved, and we're going to be willing to come alongside And we're not just going to be the people that stand in front of clinics, but we're going to be the people that stand at the back door so that when people come out, we love them and we value them and we recognize they're image bearers of God no matter what decision that they've made inside. And so we're going to be people that recognize that people are image bearers of God. People that don't look like us or act like us or behave like us or are not in our same socioeconomic standing or are people that have different skin color than us or are people that live in a different culture than us or are people that don't think the way we think. We're going to value them because they are image bearers of God. That every person, every child, every man, every woman is an image bearer of God. And we're going to value and respect and honor them as image bearers of God. We oppose attempts to devalue people. We oppose racism. We oppose injustice. We oppose abuse. We oppose mistreatment. We value people. We stand against those things because those things are sin and those things devalue image bearers. Like, I shouldn't have to stand on a stage and tell Jesus followers not to be racist people. I shouldn't have to stand on a stage and tell Jesus followers that we want to promote justice and not injustice. That we want to lift up the oppressed. We should not be about mistreatment. So we were on our flight down, delayed for about 6 hours in Fort Lauderdale was our layover. And in a six-hour delay, that you're only being updated 30 minutes at a time and not really given any explanations on why a delay is happening, and you have a plane full of people that are heading to a vacation spot and have spent a lot of money to get there, then tensions tend to rise, right, when there's no explanation. And particularly, I'm not even going to mention the airline Spirit. Oh, sorry. I'm not even going to mention the airline that this was taking place, but for an hour and a half, 2 hours, there was really no explanation on why we were sitting, and the time just kept changing. And to top it off, there was no one behind the desk to give explanation. And so no employees in sight, just delays happening. And so when these two employees arrived on the scene who had no information, let's just say there was a heightened moment of intensity that lasted for about, I don't know, 4 hours, of people kind of banging on the desk, demanding stuff, primarily explanations. And so I'm just kind of sitting back and watching this unfold. I'm not really engaged. I'm just kind of there watching and observing how humanity loves to act in those moments, and especially when a vacation's on the line. Like, if you're going on a business trip and get delayed 4 hours, that's okay. But if I'm going on a vacation, like, don't delay my flight. And I love all the unreasonable explanations that people have in that moment. Like, I'll just bring in two planes and don't worry about extra crews and let's just use that plane. Well, that plane's going to Jamaica. We'll just cancel that flight. Let us use their plane. Like, yes, that's how it works. Thank you. Thank you, Einstein, for that explanation. Wait, that person's an image bearer too. Sorry. So I'm just kind of watching this unfold and the kids would come up occasionally to kind of see it, and tensions rising and kind of the mob mentality that we tend to live with in our modern day and age. And I was reminded and just thought how quickly we can throw out things of anger and frustration and to cut people that we don't even know and to literally verbally assault people that have a story in a family and are just kind of trying to do their job and just kind of the back and the forth and the responses and the kind of the heightened tension of all this taking place. And again, there's fault, you know, on both sides, lack of information, and I'm going to get frustrated. And so there's, you know, fingers that can be pointed in a lot of different directions. But I just thought, as a follower of Jesus, like, what do we do in those moments where, how can we take a step back and recognize that every person, both the person on this side of the desk that's screaming and demanding things and this person on the desk that has no answers, like, both of those are image bearers of God. And how do we love and respond in Christ-like love in those moments? And I, honestly, like, I don't have it all figured out. Like, that's frustrating moments for me. And my heart goes certain directions toward certain actions and certain behavior, just like yours does. And so in that moment, we had to kind of have a moment of, like, step back and peace and everything. God's in control of this, and it's going to be okay, and we'll get there, and God's in control, and we don't know everything that's going on, but he does. And so in those moments, look, it's so important to remember that we are image bearers of God. And it's not just those moments, is it? It's the everyday. It's my spouse. It's my kids. It's my coworkers. That's where we live, in the grind. Like, we don't live in the, I'm going to travel and vacation. Like, that's the unique moments of life. Where this really happens is, how am I going to treat the spouse that God has placed in my life? Am I going to treat them as an image bearer of God? Am I going to love them and value them like an image bearer of God? How am I going to treat these precious kids that God has given me as image bearers of God? You know what? That's really where my reactions have to be tamed and controlled, right? I mean, vacation does, it's awesome to have celebration together and family time together, but if you're like us, it's kind of also in those family times that tensions can kind of, you know, think we don't get to eat where we want, or everybody's got a different opinion of where we're going to eat, and man, the tensions go fast, don't they? You know, I had to have, like, conversations with the kids, like, man, Dad doesn't always get it right. I'm a reactionary person too, and a couple of the kids, I won't name them, their personality's like mine, and so things can clash quickly, Kaylee, and so it's, but in those moments, we have to have conversations as dad and kids and mom and wife and siblings, like, these are image bearers. Like, how do we love each other like Christ loves? That's what we're talking about. We're talking about image bearers, that we are created as the image bearers of God, and that we value people. We do not devalue them. And then I'll just remind us as we end today, we're created for community, aren't we? That we are created for relationship, for community. And so we avoid the push toward autonomy that our culture forces on us, and we contend for community, that we respect and value and forgive, and we practice hospitality, and we seek to live in fellowship. As we long for this eternal redemption, when God will make all things new, we long for that. We long for that day when God will recreate, when God will make everything right. And in the process, in the in-between, between the bookends, we suffer well. We suffer as people who follow God. We endure trial and pain and loss and hardship and hurt with an eternal hope that the story's been written, that the Creator God, in the beginning God, is the same God that's there in the end. And we keep our eyes focused on him. So here's what I leave us with today. God is really big. You heard it last week. You hear it again today. God is really big. Take time in your life consistently to acknowledge the bigness. Gaze upon it. Look at whatever that is for you. For a lot of us, it is like when you go to the ocean and you see it, like you recognize, like, it's really big and I'm really small. And there is a big God who spoke this into existence. Like, acknowledge the bigness of God. We gaze upon the created world. We gaze upon the ocean and the skies and the created world around us. And we are reminded that he is really big. Our God is a big God. And we worship him as a really big God. God is big. And we're also reminded we are small. Here's what I say to you. Don't lose sight of the big and be focused on the small. That's where our eyes go. Our eyes tend to go to the small, to the device in our hands or what's on our screen in front of us, or the discouragement that I'm feeling at work, or the pettiness in my marriage, or what's happening in my bank account. Like, our eyes tend to get focused on the small because we are small creatures. And over and over and over again in the scriptures, particularly in the Psalms, we are called to get our eyes up, to get our eyes off of the smallness, and to get our eyes on the bigness. Because when you are gazing on the bigness, then the smallness will take care of itself. Did you hear me? When you focus and gaze upon the bigness, the smallness tends to take care of itself. Because you recognize he is big. And he is sovereign. He's bigger than my frustrations. He's bigger than my uncertainties. He is in control of those things. And then we always bring this back to the gospel. We're a gospel-centered church and preaching and teaching. God is big and we are small. And God the Son, God Himself, bridged that gap. That's the gospel. That this really big God looks down upon the smallness of His creation, as we'll see next week, who has sinned against Him. And He doesn't remove Himself. He doesn't stay aloof. He doesn't say, good luck down there. God, this really big God, enters into the smallness. He takes on human flesh and He bridges the gap. And the gospel says the Creator God became the creation. That the Creator God became the created to bridge the gap between this holy and big God and this small and finite and sinful humanity. That God entered into our space. That He descended to us. That He came down to us to bridge the gap between those two. And that is the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. As we gaze upon the goodness, we are reminded that this big God cares about me. He entered my space through His Son so that I might have a relationship with this really big and sovereign God. All of Genesis puts us into this redemptive story that is pushing us through the rest of the Bible, that from the beginning of time there was a God who had a redemptive purpose in mind. And all of these characters from Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, all the ones we'll look at, they fit within a bigger redemptive story that there is coming a Messiah who will bridge the gap between the big God and the small human. He is really big. You can lean into Him. So before we went on vacation, Levi has been taking swim lessons because we wanted to get him ready for the water. And he does really awesome swimming underwater and those things, but he still needs someone. He's like 2 and a half, and so he's not able to swim on his own. He needs something, either some type of little life preserver, or most often he wants one of us to be with him while he's in the pool, which was about 90% of the vacation for him. He wanted to be in the pool. And so the longer he's in the water, the more confidence he gains as a little boy. And he's swimming between us, you know, putting his little head under and pushing him over to another adult. And he gets braver and braver and braver. And the pool had kind of about the big as a stage, a very shallow area. And then it had steps that go out into the deeper end. And Levi would wander down a step or two and then jump over to one of us. But again, as the week went, the more confident he got, and suddenly he is Mr. Confidence, and I don't need people, and I'm self-reliant, and I'm independent. He didn't say all those things, but that's what's going on in his little depraved mind. And so, last day, gets down on step two. He's about chest deep water. No one, I mean, we're all kind of in the general vicinity watching him, but here he goes. I'm going in. And down he goes, and we're pulling him up, and he's coughing and spewing and crying and everything that happens when you get a good mouthful of water as a little kid. But we're just reminded in that moment, like, he's expressing his independence, but he's still very, what, dependent. As a matter of fact, he's life and death dependent. And isn't that us? Like, that's our tendency, that God has created us and placed us in this world in which we live, the created world that we live, and we have our shallow end, and we gain all this confidence that we are all that. And Paul says in Romans 1 that the created tries to take the place of the creator, and the next thing you know, here we are. We're off in the deep end thinking we got it figured out, and God reminds us, like, I'm independent and you're not. You're dependent, but that's why I'm here. I'm your Father. Not going to let you go to the bottom and stay and stand at the top like, you learned your lesson now, didn't you, boy? No, I'm going to pull him up. I'm going to help him breathe. I'm going to get his feet under him. I'm going to help him understand you still need daddy and mommy. And that's what he does for us over and over. Our Heavenly Father, as we launch out into our independence and think we got it figured out, he picks us up and lets us breathe and says, you still need me. Rest in me. I'm here for you. Underneath are the everlasting arms, Moses said, holding us up. Really, really big God that you can trust in today and rest in.